lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the damp, foggy midnight, you snort my good pony and you give me.
You're listening to episode 687 of Unwelcome Guests. Is 50 years enough? I'm Robin Upton. Now, the title, in case you've missed earlier episodes, is a reference to Mark Gorton's essay, 50 Years of the Deep State, that was published on the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination. We're going to be concluding our reading of that, supplemented by an interview with veteran deep politics researcher Professor Beta Dale Scott. Now, we've looked at the JFK assassination and the 9/11 operation several times on the show, but we've never before looked at the close connections and the parallels, at least not so explicitly. As we shall hear, there are a remarkable number of parallels, from the setup, the operation itself, the execution, the cover-up, people profiteering from insider knowledge. If the JFK assassination was carried out by a lone nut and the 9/11 op was carried out by a small gang of religious extremists without help from people inside the deep state, then these parallels are basically inexplicable. But Mark Gorton is correct that the 9/11 op was the capstone of a 15-year project by a very small group of insiders at the heart of the deep state, some of whom were intimately involved in the JFK assassination, then we can't be too surprised about this. We've got a slightly different format this time. Rather than having one and then followed by the other, we're going to intersperse the two main sources. So we're going to chop and change between the Peter Dale Scott interview and my reading of Mark Gorton's essay. We're going to start, this is Project Censored's Mickey Huff, on the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination.
Peter Dale Scott, you've been following the JFK assassination for probably 50 years now. Tell us your history and how you saw it initially. How did you see it when you found out? What did you think about it?
Well, I came in really through the back door because my interest was the Vietnam War and how to stop it. And I did a book with Franz Sherman and Reggie Zelnick called The Politics of Escalation. I think it was the first anti-war book to come out in 1966. And I just asked a question in one of my chapters in that book. Is it a coincidence that Prime Minister of Vietnam, Nguyen Xuân Diem, started to explore the possibility of neutralization and an end to the war, and he was then assassinated, clearly with CIA involvement, and then 3 weeks later, the president, who was also beginning to explore withdrawal from Vietnam, he also was assassinated 3 weeks later, but it was just a question. But the question rested in my mind, and I began to get more and more interested in it. And I wouldn't say I was really primarily pursuing the Kennedy assassination until about 1970, and I became very interested around then.
Well, you have written fairly extensively about Kennedy's efforts for global peace, and certainly Memorandum 263, which was his declaration to remove 1,000 troops from Vietnam early on.
By the end of 63, and the bulk of them by 65.
So it was clear that his desires at that point were to withdraw from Vietnam and move towards greater compatibility with the Soviet Union and even some attempts at reconciliation with Fidel Castro.
Yes, I think they're actually all more interconnected than most historians have recognized, because I think that all through 63, Khrushchev was pulling troops out of Cuba. He had about 17,000 troops in Cuba, And through 63, he was pulling them. And McCone, I think, estimated in August it was down to about 8,000 or something. Well, no one's ever explained why. They kept saying the war was going well in Vietnam for the American point of view in 63, but Kennedy pushed up the number of troops that we had in Vietnam from 9,000 to, guess what, 17,000. So I think it's not a coincidence that you had a parity of troops in the two countries, Cuba and Vietnam, at the same time, and that one of Kennedy's secret negotiations with Khrushchev involved a phased withdrawal on both sides. You get more troops out of Cuba, we'll get more troops out of Vietnam. And that was actually, I think, happening, and it disturbed certain people, and it was, of course, stopped. It was actually announced on November 20th, 2 days before Kennedy was killed, that 1,000 troops would be withdrawn before the end of the year, and they never were. So those people who say it makes no difference if you have Kennedy or if you have Johnson, one of the first things you can point to is this troop withdrawal, which was announced, and they had 5 weeks in which to do it, and it wasn't done.
Part of what you've written about is the idea that Lyndon Johnson was receiving different intelligence than Kennedy was at the time, and that there were certainly elements inside the Pentagon that not only wanted to see the war in Vietnam grow and expand, but were really rabid anti-communists in the sense of maintaining a really hard line with the Soviet Union. At the same time, when Kennedy, John Kennedy, is starting to have these communications with Khrushchev,
right.
Because of the severity and the closeness that we came during the Cuban Missile Crisis to a nuclear exchange.
Yes, I think that certainly educated both Kennedy and Khrushchev to the need to rethink the Cold War. And we have to look at this at different levels. I mean, first of all, it's quite clear Kennedy's American University speech on June 10th, 1963, you have to have lived in those days to understand just how extraordinary this was, that he was saying we are all mortal. I mean, that we have a common interest in preserving the planet from a nuclear disaster. And this was very, very new. Something that seems rather minor now, perhaps, the Test Ban Treaty in August. That was the first treaty that had been signed with the Soviet Union since the Austrian Peace Treaty of 1955. And the argument against it wasn't the details of the test ban. It was you cannot sign a treaty with the Soviet Union because they are atheist communists and their commitments mean nothing at all, and only a traitor would have any idea of doing something like this. So there was extraordinary opposition inside the military, inside Congress, through the establishment of the country to dealing with the Soviet Union. And then when you come down a notch to the future of the war in Vietnam, I'll just give you my own take on it because there are many, but I think the oil companies had their eyes on oil in the South China Sea, and Mobil Oil in particular, which is a Rockefeller company. It's part of the old Standard Oil Trust. It used to be called Saucony Vacuum there. Saucony was Standard Oil Company of New York. So it was one of the basic companies, but they were short of foreign resources. Unlike we talked about the Seven Sisters in those days, the big mm-hmm. oil companies. All of them had, by the terms of those days, enough resources except Saucony Vacuum. And so this man, William Henderson from Saucony Vacuum, he was lobbying up and down in the country in the Council on Foreign Relations and in various journals that we need to have a bigger military commitment in Southeast Asia. Why? Well, they talked a bit about the domino theory said so we can protect Indonesia and so on. But I think they specifically were interested in the waters off Cambodia and Vietnam. And the Cambodia incursion in 1970 was involved the Lon Nol government that was signing. Most people don't know this, but I have a chapter on it in my Drugs, Oil, and War, about signing contracts with Western oil companies, which were fulfilled. They're drilling. Their oil is coming out from that area. And, of course, they never got, there was a setback when we, in effect, lost the war in Vietnam. But lo and behold, 20 years later in the 1990s, who is drilling oil in Vietnamese waters? It's Mobil. They got the oil in the end, even though they didn't win the war that they thought was necessary to get it. So that's why there was pressure. Obviously, there were people in the military who also wanted that war. But there's a new book out by Christopher Ricks that says that really the old guard in the military were not so keen on this war. It was Maxwell Taylor, Kennedy's preferred choice to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs. He was a proponent of limited war, and he wanted to have a limited war, and more or less he was the heart of the military push for involvement there.
And there certainly were companies like Bell who were building helicopters that became one of the primary war machines in Vietnam.
Oh, yes. Once the war was launched, you had a huge helicopter lobby, Bell in particular, and also Boeing, because when we were bombing North Vietnam, we lost an awful lot of B-52s. It was terrible for the pilots in them. It was terrible for the North Vietnamese, but it was wonderful for Boeing. So they, too, were Boeing and Bell. The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower had warned about became very invested in the Vietnam War when it was going. And when one of my theories, which I've mentioned, and I think it finally in the war conspiracy, there was a company down in Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area called Ling Temco Vought, LTV. And James Ling, who was the head of that company, teamed up with a man called David Byrd, D.H. Byrd. They called him Dry Hole Byrd because of his oil drilling fiascos. But he also owned a Texas school book depository where Oswald was supposed to have shot Kennedy. And the two men, the owner of LTV and the owner of the school book depository, they formed an investment company and bought a lot of shares in LTV just before the assassination. It's just like before 9/11, somebody was buying shares, selling short in the shares of the airline that went down. And I did the math on that investment. They put in $2.5 million. And by 1965, that was worth about $50 million because the first contract that was awarded by the Pentagon under Lyndon Johnson was to LTV for what they called the Vietnam fighter, the A-6 fighter. When that contract was let in January of 64. So I've always wondered if that wasn't part of the background, what I call the deep politics of the Kennedy assassination.
And now we're going to switch to Mark Gorton. This section isn't actually the next one in the order he produced the essay, but I chopped and changed it around to emphasize the parallels between the two events. 9/11 as a massive financial crime. The criminal syndicate behind 9/11 also used the terrorist attacks as cover for a series of financial crimes. These crimes are less well researched than many other aspects of the 9/11 op, and I suspect that we'll have continuing revelations on this front. The best documented aspect of the financial crimes has been the widespread insider trading that took place prior to the 9/11 attacks. Jonathan Weiner, a financial consultant, told ABC, quote, "It's absolutely unprecedented to see cases of insider trading covering the entire world, from Japan to the US to North America to Europe," unquote. After the 9/11 attacks, the German central bank studied the possibility of insider trading. According to the German central bank president, Ernst Welticker, the German researchers found, quote, almost irrefutable proof of insider trading, unquote. Welticker was blunt, quote, what we found makes us sure that people connected to the terrorists must have been trying to profit from this tragedy, unquote. Some of the unusual trading in put options was conducted by Deutsche Bank Alex Braun, whose CEO Buzzy Krongard had long-standing ties to the CIA, and left Alex Braun in March 2001 to become executive director of the CIA. However, the SEC was not forthcoming about its own investigation and treated these inquiries as if they were state secrets. The SEC quickly concluded that there was no insider trading and, in a highly unusual move, destroyed all of its records of the investigation. In addition to insider trading, other sophisticated financial frauds were part of the 9/11 op. Convar, a company specializing in computer disaster recovery, found evidence that unusually large sums of money, perhaps more than $100 million, were rushed through the computers in the World Trade Center as the disaster unfolded. A Deutsche Bank employee told investigative reporter Mike Ruppert that, quote, about 5 minutes before the attack, the entire Deutsche Bank computer system had been taken over by something external that no one in the office recognized, and every file was downloaded at lightning speed to an unknown location, unquote. The details of what happened in the bond market are not completely clear, but there appears to be strong evidence that a major financial crime was committed, perhaps the largest theft in U.S. history. It's also possible that there is a benign explanation for the following set of facts, but given the level of sophistication and comprehensive nature of the Bush Syndicate, the benign explanation strikes me as unlikely. The targeted nature of the airplane strikes appears to have been a deliberate attempt to cause chaos in the U.S. government bond market. The plane which hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center crashed right into the offices of Cantor Fitzgerald, the largest interdealer broker of U.S. government bonds, while in the South Tower, the offices of Eurobrokers, another large interdealer broker, were in the impact zone of the second plane strike. In the wake of the chaos in the bond market, the regular rules for settling trades were suspended and the conditions for a huge financial crime were created. Trade breaks are a regular occurrence in the financial markets and standard procedures exist to allow for the nullification of trades without a counterparty. However, in the days following 9/11, rather than use the established procedures for dealing with unmatched trades, in an unprecedented action, the SEC suspended normal rules and allowed for blind brokered trades. Despite the damage to Lower Manhattan, the fixed income clearing operations of most banks were unaffected. But in the days following September the 11th, the Bank of New York was overdue on over $100 billion in payments. However, none of the Bank of New York systems failed or went non-operational. As the New York Times reported, quote, bank executives argue that some of the criticism has taken on some aspects of urban legend, especially the notion that the bank was in disarray because the main backup for its computer center in Lower Manhattan was at another location in Lower Manhattan. The bank says that all of its several computer centers in Manhattan were always set to revert to centers outside of the city in case of emergency, and they did on September the 11th, unquote. September the 11th, 2001, was no ordinary day for the financial markets. By mid-morning, all of Lower Manhattan, including the financial district, had been evacuated. Across the country, business slowed as people put their normal lives on hold, to either react to the attacks or just watch the events unfold on TV. As a result, both the number and volume of transactions sending funds through the financial system was much lower than average throughout the day of 9/11. However, starting at around 6 p.m. and continuing to midnight, a huge amount of money started flowing through the banking system. Although many billions of dollars were flowing through the system, This large flow of funds was handled with only a small number of transactions. What really happened in the financial markets in the days following 9/11 is hard to know, but evidence exists of highly unusual trade flows, an unprecedented suspension of the normal rules for processing trades, massive coordinated insider trading that was covered up by the SEC, an incredibly sophisticated black op run by people with a history of running financial frauds, a computer systems takeover at Deutsche Bank, an $100 billion plus trade settlement problem at the Bank of New York, blamed on systems problems, yet the Bank of New York never had any systems problems. Given the lack of any investigation into these possible financial crimes, not enough evidence exists to form a clear opinion as to what happened. But the above pattern of facts is consistent with a massive $100 billion plus financial crime as part of the 9/11 op. And if you're interested in more details of 9/11 as a complex financial crime, I refer you to the second hour of episode 621. Now we return to the Peter Dale Scott interview.
Let me start with deep politics, and then we'll get to what I call deep events, like the Kennedy assassination. Deep politics is a term which I had to use to be able to conceptualize and write about what it was I had to say about the Kennedy assassination. And I did a whole book called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and I said, I'm not trying to solve it, and I'm not even particularly, what does solving the case mean? Does it mean we find up the gunman saying, I shot the gun? That wouldn't answer the questions that I'm interested in. I'm not interested in who shot the gun. I'm interested in why the president was shot and what interests were served by that. And to look on that level, you have to look underneath the surface at things which are not acknowledged. And so my definition of deep politics in that book is all those political processes that are usually repressed, not talked about, rather than acknowledged. And actually, I came in, I really did it in connection with Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby was the man who shot Oswald on television 2 days after the assassination, which was certainly an event which merits as much investigation as the shooting of the president. And, of course, the thesis of the Warren Commission and their report was that both men were loners. Lee Harvey Oswald wanted to be famous, and so no one paid any attention to him. We now know that wasn't true because the CIA was not only maintaining files on him, but significantly escalated their files on Oswald in the weeks just before the assassination, which makes you wonder if they didn't have something to do with it. And Jack Ruby, even more conspicuously, that's why I knew nothing about American politics at that time, but just a little bit of investigation of this supposed loner Jack Ruby turned out that, he had connections to organized crime, but more than that, he ran a nightclub or a couple of nightclubs in Dallas, and they were strip joints. Well, Dallas culture being what it was, strippers were used not just in strip joints, but also at big parties given by very rich oil men. So Jack Ruby knew a lot of the oil men. Well, he was not a loner. He was well known. He was a character who was recognized. And in particular, he had very close connections with the Dallas police, and in fact employed Dallas police to be bouncers in his clubs. And I found one of the very few published pre-assassination FBI reports on Jack Ruby was about a drug deal that went through Dallas, a big one, and the man who had to give the okay on the drug deal was Jack Ruby, according to this FBI file. So this FBI file was suggesting that Jack Ruby was, in fact, the connection between the underworld in Dallas, who were quite powerful, and the Dallas police. Well, you couldn't have a better example of what I mean by deep politics that crime in Dallas wasn't just regulated by the police, it was also regulated by the mob. The organized crime serves a function in society. That's why it's tolerated. I thought at one point of calling tolerated crime. They certainly had an understanding with the Dallas police that small-time drug dealers got turned in, got arrested, made good publicity for everybody. Big-time drug dealers went through no problem. And that was true in 1963, and may I say it's still true in 2013. It's part of the way that this country runs. We still have a prohibition. It's obvious to everyone that to have prohibition of liquor when everyone wanted liquor was a boon to the mafia. That's what really consolidated organized crime in America. Well, don't forget, we still have a prohibition. It's not liquor anymore, it's drugs. But there is still that very powerful demand which is met by very highly organized thing. My last book, American War Machine, the title is about the war machine, but a good deal of the content is about how there is this drug, organized drug system in the country, in the world, and how the CIA finds it very useful, used it in Mexico, used it in Thailand, used it in Laos and Vietnam. And then, of course, currently we're using drug dealers in Afghanistan. Both times, first time 1980 and second time in 2001, our first connections were there with big-time drug traffickers who became CIA assets in order to fight the enemy, whatever it was.
So in the context of John F. Kennedy and people who didn't like his administration, so to speak, and this wasn't just Catholic and political.
Oh, he had enemies. Yes, he certainly did.
He certainly had some serious enemies.
Yes.
Dulles, of course, who he fired, or the CIA.
That's a big one. Alan Dulles.
Alan Dulles.
John Dulles was dead.
Alan Dulles. So not only was the CIA unhappy, the Cubans, the right-wing Cubans, the ones at the Bay of Pigs, were very unhappy.
Right.
And Kennedy felt he had been lied to about the Bay of Pigs, and that's why he didn't trust the CIA. And Robert of the Justice Department was going after the organized crime in many ways.
Yes.
Including Hoffa.
And there's an overlap there, too, because a lot of the people who came out of Cuba were organized crime figures. The biggest American presence in Havana before had been the casinos. Very much the same. The
world of Jack Ruby had been down there doing bag money work, correct?
Yeah, three times in 1959 after Castro came to power, Jack Ruby flew to Cuba. He said, as a tourist, he said, three times in 1 year? No, he went out to Trescornia prison where Santo Trafficante was interned. He seems to have met Trafficante. He had a very close friend, Louis McWillie, who was in charge of one of the casinos there, and then came back and was at the Cal Neva right up here on Lake Tahoe, which where Sam Giancana had an interest. So Jack Ruby was part of that world and a functioning part, because, yes, I think that's what the House Committee on Assassinations concluded, that he was probably getting cash out each time he went in there, because they were stuck with an awful lot of cash in Cuba, which they couldn't reach.
Which reminds me that a lot of people don't remember that the House Committee on Assassinations did come to the conclusion that the John F. Kennedy killing was, in fact, a conspiracy.
A 95% probability of a conspiracy, they
said. Well, that's pretty high.
Yeah, it's high.
Right. But. Of course, the Warren Commission didn't go there.
Not at all.
And what did the Warren Commission ignore? I mean, certainly Jack Ruby's crime connections was one of them.
That's the first thing you have to say. They completely ignored, and it's so pathetic when you look at the reasons. You know, I'll give credit to the commission that they published 26 volumes of hearings and evidence. So when they said Jack Ruby was not crime connected, they're quoting somebody. And then when you look up in the footnotes to find who said it, it was, I think, Accardo, one of the heads of organized crime in Chicago. So the FBI went to organized crime to ask the question, is he one of your guys? And they said, no. The FBI said, great. And they put it in a memo, and the Warren Commission published it as fact. And That's an extreme example, but the whole case that Ruby was not organized crime connected, because it's entirely fictitious, the evidence for it is all bogus. And it was relatively easy to show how pathetic it was. In fact, Ruby was quite close to some of the very big killings in Chicago. There was a man called James Reagan who was killed in 1947, I think, in the 40s anyway. And the three suspected killers who were not not charged, because it was a very high-level political killing with protection for the killers. And Jack Ruby knew all three. And Chicago organized crime moved down in an organized way to Dallas, 1949 and 50. Jack Ruby moved from Chicago down to Dallas, 1949 and 50. Was he part of that move? Well, he knew all the people who were in the move. So whatever his status in organized crime was, he was part of, he knew the crime figures and he knew the police figures. And that's the first thing that the Warren Commission had in effect to lie about. Well, to repeat the lies that the FBI were repeating from Tony Accardo. Of course, the fatal flaw in the Warren Commission was that the man who did most of the direction of the work was not Chief Justice Warren. He was still full-time on the Supreme Court. The man who was free to do it was Alan Dulles, who had been fired just 2 years earlier by John F. Kennedy. The very fact that one of the most prominent victims of Kennedy's political policies was named to the commission should have made people be suspicious from the outset. And not only that, but Dulles acted, he put somebody, the man who was the go-between between the CIA and the commission shouldn't have been that person because of his closeness to what the CIA had been doing. I'm going to say, I cannot prove that the CIA had been doing something with Lee Harvey Oswald before the assassination, but I can certainly say categorically they had been doing something with the Lee Harvey Oswald files. They had been manipulating those files to the extent that on one day the same people sent out two different messages about Lee Harvey Oswald which contradicted each other. They said, one cable said, we have no news of him since 1962, and the other one brought it up to the present. I've written about this. I have an explanation for that. But all we need to know here is Lee Harvey Oswald was in their sights and they were using the files. He was also involved in New Orleans. He came back from the Soviet Union in 1961, and for months and months and months, he did nothing political that we know about. And then suddenly, in the spring of 63, Oswald goes to New Orleans, and by August, he's connected with a group called the Director, I'll call them the DRE. It was a Cuban group that was financed by the CIA, that was part of CIA operations. And then he got into a highly publicized debate, and he got into arrest. He was leafleting. He was, the sum of his activities was to, he was a self-professed member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. He was the head of the New Orleans chapter, which had one member, himself. And he was doing things that ended up on television linking the Fair Play for Cuba Committee to a man, that is to say Oswald himself, who had defected to the Soviet Union, making it look like a communist front. Well, I think all of that was designed to blacken the reputation of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. And interestingly, we find that the CIA and the FBI both had projects at that time to do exactly that. cannot prove that Oswald was part of those things, but we can prove that amazing things were happening in the CIA files. And then in the FBI file, look what happened there. Oswald got himself arrested in August 1963 for his fair play for Cuba activities. So you'd think, well, that would get the FBI more interested in him. What actually happens in October of 63 is that Oswald is taken off the watch list for dangerous communists who have to be watched. He's doing all these various things, and they take him off the watch list. Why did they take him off the watch list? I believe they took him off the watch list because as he was accelerating his political activities, he had become, in advance, the designated culprit for the Kennedy assassination, and it was very important that nobody pick him up, and as he might have been. And I developed this idea that there's a designated culprit because, and there was more than one, actually, in the Kennedy assassination, some that you've not heard of. But the same thing happened with 9/11, that there were people who should have been watched by the FBI. The CIA wouldn't tell the FBI about these people. It was a complete violation of their procedures. And the FBI knew that the CIA was withholding evidence. I'm talking about 9/11 now. And got very angry in August of 2001, just 3 weeks before 9/11. An FBI agent sort of pounding the table says, somebody's going to get killed because of this. And yet the same thing happened. Why? Because the designated culprits were two of the alleged hijackers. My mind is open as to whether they were actually on the plane or not, but they were certainly part of the plot. And they shouldn't be, it would ruin everything if they got picked up before 9/11, just as it would have ruined everything if Oswald had been picked up before the Kennedy assassination. So that brings me to an expanded view of deep politics, which says that we study things about the Kennedy assassination, and it helps us understand, look for key points of similarity with 9/11, and may I say Watergate. Now that you mentioned deep events earlier, these are what I call deep events, events which happen and which we know we are not going to get a straight account of in the press, and they are presented as the actions of people who are very, very marginal and of no interest to historians. But my theory of American history is that, in fact, these deep events, and particularly the Kennedy assassination at one end and the 9/11 at the other, but also Watergate, all of them, the string of deep events, actually steer our history and are largely responsible for us being the warmongering power that America has become in the last 50 years.
The 9/11 investigation cover-ups. In the aftermath of 9/11, Congress sponsored two government-run investigations into the 9/11 attacks. The first, the Joint Inquiry into Intelligence Community Activities Before and After the Terrorist Attacks of September 11, 2001, was run by Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss. Porter Goss was a longtime CIA agent. He was a member of Operation 40, a CIA task force active in anti-Castro activity around the time of the Bay of Pigs operation. Many members of Operation 40 played an active role in the coup of 63. Goss spent the entire early 1960s based at JM Wave, the CIA station in Miami, where he worked with Ted Shackley, David Sanchez Morales, Edward Lansdale, William Harvey, and Tracy Barnes, all of whom were active players in the coup of 63. Porter Goss was also involved in the Iran-Contra profiteering, where he earned $12 million on a series of fraudulent deals. Bob Graham was also a participant in some Iran-Contra-related fraudulent investments. Goss and Graham made it clear that their goal was not to identify specific wrongdoing. Graham said the inquiry would not play, quote, the blame game about what went wrong from an intelligence perspective, unquote. Goss said, quote, this is not a who shall we hang type of investigation. It's about where are the gaps in America's defense and what do we do about it type of investigation, unquote. However, despite the compromised nature of the investigators and the limited mission of the inquiry, and its being under-resourced, the joint inquiry did document a clear connection between the Saudi government and the 9/11 attacks. However, the 28 pages in the report that documented Saudi government and intelligence ties to the hijackers were classified by President Bush. Senator Graham has repeatedly spoken out about the Saudi government connection. In 2011, Graham wrote in the Daily Beast, quote, "Why would Saudi Arabia do this? Do the Saudis have the will and capability to aid future attacks against the United States? And most important, why the cover-up by our government? I have attempted to address these questions in the final report of the Congressional Commission and the non-fiction book Intelligence Matters, published in 2004. Each was censored by authorities in the intelligence community, particularly on the role of the Saudis in 9/11. Unquote. After protests from the families of the 9/11 victims about a lack of investigation into the attacks, President Bush reluctantly created the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States, also known as the 9/11 Commission. Like the vast majority of congressional committees investigating high-level government crimes, the 9/11 Commission was designed to be a cover-up. Senator Max Cleland, one of the only vigilant members of the commission, stepped down in December 2003 and became an outspoken critic of the cover-up. Cleland later said, quote, "This is a scam. It's disgusting. America is being cheated. As each day goes by, we learn that this government knew a whole lot more about these terrorists before September the 11th than it has ever admitted. Let's chase this rabbit into the ground. They had a plan to go to war, and when 9/11 happened, that's what they did. They went to war." Unquote. 9/11 Commission co-chair Lee Hamilton says, quote, "I don't believe for a minute that we got everything right," unquote, that the commission was set up to fail, that people should keep asking questions about 9/11, and that the 9/11 debate should continue. John Farmer, the senior counsel to the 9/11 Commission, who led the 9/11 staff's inquiry, said, quote, "At some level of government, at some point in time, there was an agreement not to tell the truth about what happened." Unquote. He also said, quote, "I was shocked at how different the truth was from the way it was described. The tapes told a radically different story from what had been told to us and the public for 2 years. This is not spin. This is not true. It's almost a culture of concealment, for lack of a better word. There were interviews made at the FAA's New York Center the night of 9/11, and those tapes were destroyed. The CIA tapes of the interrogations were destroyed. The story of 9/11 itself, to put it mildly, was distorted and was completely different from the way things happened." Unquote. Raymond McGovern, a 27-year CIA veteran who chaired National Intelligence Estimates and personally delivered intelligence briefings to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, their vice presidents, secretaries of state, the joint chiefs of staff, and many other government officials, said, quote, "I think at simplest terms, there's a cover-up. The 9/11 report is a joke." Unquote. Melvin Goodman, division chief of the CIA's Office of Soviet Affairs, who served as senior analyst from 1966 to 1990 and professor of international security at the National War College from 1986 to 2004, said, quote, "The final 9/11 Commission report is ultimately a cover-up." Unquote.
It was clear, I think, from the outset that there was not going to be a sincere investigation of who killed President Kennedy. In other words, from the very beginning, there were all kinds of obvious reasons how Oswald couldn't have done it. The gun that he was supposed to have bought was much too clumsy an instrument to have pulled off, a feat of marksmanship that nobody could replicate. The FBI hired the top marksman in the country to replicate it with a vehicle that was not moving. And they could not do in the 6.8 seconds or whatever it was what Oswald was supposed to have done with a moving vehicle, where maybe there was a tree obstructing the first shot. So there were all kinds of problems. And yet, this is what I mean about the deep event. When Oswald was shot on November 24th, 2 days after the president was killed, the headline in the New York Times was, "President's Assassin Shot." So they had already decided who did it. The FBI then very quickly did a report that decided that it was Oswald very, very quickly before getting into the evidence. The very first meeting of the Warren Commission, we now have that meeting, and there is Alan Dulles saying, of course, what we have to show is how all American assassins are not like European assassins. They're always loners. And actually, John McCloy, who's chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank, to his credit, he said, well, I don't think John Wilkes Booth was a loner, because if you know anything about the Lincoln assassination, there were three targets, two of whom were shot almost simultaneously in widely separated parts of Washington. And Alan Dulles, very cool, came back. He said, well, but John Wilkes Booth was so in charge that he was virtually a loner, even though he had a team. We now know that he had deep roots to the Southern Confederate Intelligence Network, though American historians don't like to emphasize that. But coming back, the commission was presented at their first official meeting with a complete agenda of what the chapters would be, and the first chapter was Oswald as the assassin. So they had the agenda before they had the investigation. That's a classic example of a deep event. And I've always felt Watergate was another deep event. There's a lot of things we did learn about Nixon and Watergate, but I don't think we ever learned why those burglars were in the Democratic National Committee in the beginning. It was a disaster for Nixon. I don't think Nixon ordered it. Well, that raises the question, who did? We were never given a chance to find out. And then 9/11. Most recently, it was Syria. And we've had, I don't know if I'm getting off the subject here, but this question of chemical weapons in Syria, right away, Kerry is saying, we know who did it. And only an idiot would challenge who did it. Well, I'm one of those idiots. I don't know who did it, but I know enough to know that it's far from an open and shut case that the Syrian government did it. And common sense would say to me that the people who had most to gain by using the chemical weapons were the rebels, because they wanted America to come in. So why would Bashar do that? Doesn't make sense. That's another deep event.
It's certainly false flags as deep events.
Deep events are often false flags, yes. Tonkin Gulf, for example, the second Tonkin Gulf incident turns out to have been a non-incident. I've written about this in my last, well, more than once, actually. I originally in the New York Review of Books, when I was not persona non grata as a conspiracy theorist, that very obviously the second incident was visible in Washington because of the very careful massaging of the available evidence. And there's now been a study saying that there were 115 pieces of evidence, and 90 of them said that there had not been an incident. But those are the ones that didn't go up to the White House, and the ones that went up were the ones that said. And same thing happened in the CIA. Somebody was about to send in a report saying it didn't happen, and his superior came in, so you can't send that. The decision had already been made, so the Tonkin Gulf was a deep event. And we have them all the time.
So with Lee Harvey Oswald, he's in the military, he's trained in Russian, he defects to Russia, mm-hmm. comes back with a Russian wife, and then creates this or becomes part of this Fair Play for Cuba.
Eventually, yes.
Eventually. Then ends up working at the Book Depository through special arrangements from people inside government.
Right.
And then the route that Kennedy's going to take is changed the day before to bring his car by that building.
There's a lot of debate about that now, Peter. Everything you said up to that last statement I agree with. And 3 months ago I would have agreed with the last statement too. I've seen a very cogent argument that the alleged maps and so on, that it gets very technical here. But let's just stick with the crude part of it, that this man is given a job on what becomes the parade route, which is arranged by very high political people in connection with the Secret Service. And is it just a coincidence that this man with this very checkered past, he has what you would call the perfect legend for a killer, because he went to the Soviet Union. He also left the Soviet Union. He didn't like America. He didn't like Russia. He wanted to go to Cuba, but he didn't get to Cuba. So you can read anything you want into this Rorschach test of a background. So he's the perfect candidate for a designated culprit. Is it a coincidence? No, I think he was placed there. I can't prove it, but I agree with those who say that Manliker Carcano, it might have conceivably hit the president. It didn't kill the president. There was crossfire. There was another gunman. When you find that the Zapruder film, when it was printed in Life magazine, they altered the order of the frames in order to conceal the fact that the president's head goes sharply backwards, which is not what you would expect from a shot coming from the back. Well, there's huge literature in all of this. I'm mentioning this because that huge literature is corroboration. We have a deep event.
The press cover-up. Integral to the 9/11 op has been the media cover, leveraging many decades of work on controlling the press by the national security state. The Bush Syndicate continued the ongoing program of press control to effectively censor coverage of 9/11. The mechanics of the media cover-up involve a number of different components. In the wake of the 9/11 attacks, the country came together in a burst of patriotic fervor. The Bush administration skillfully manipulated this patriotic response to create an environment where questioning the government was considered unpatriotic. Air Force Colonel and key Pentagon official Karen Kwiatkowski, who blew the whistle on the Bush administration's to concoct false intelligence about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, wrote, quote, "I've been told by reporters that they will not report their own insights or contrary evaluations of the official 9/11 story, because to question the government story about 9/11 is to question the very foundations of our entire modern belief system regarding our government, our country, and our way of life. To be charged with questioning these foundations is far more serious than being labeled a disgruntled conspiracy nut or anti-government traitor, or even being sidelined or marginalized within an academic government service or literary career. To question the official 9/11 story is simply and fundamentally revolutionary. In this way, of course, questioning the official story is also simply and fundamentally American." Unquote. Several months after 9/11, famed news anchor Dan Rather told the BBC that American reporters were practicing, quote, "a form of self-censorship," unquote. There was a time in South Africa that people would put flaming tires around people's necks if they dissented. And in some ways, the fear is that you'll be necklaced here. You'll have a flaming tire of lack of patriotism put around your neck. Now, it is that fear that keeps journalists from asking the toughest of the tough questions. And again, I am humble to say I do not exempt myself from this criticism. What we're talking about here, whether one wants to recognize it or not, or call it by its proper name or not, is a form of self-censorship. Unquote. The head of CNN agreed, quote, "There was almost a patriotism police after 9/11, and when the network showed things critical of the administration's policies, it would get calls from advertisers and the administration, and big people in corporations were calling up and saying, 'You're being anti-American here.'" Unquote. Keith Olbermann said, quote, "You can rock the boat, but you can never say that the entire ocean is in trouble. You cannot say, 'By the way, there's something wrong with our system.'" Unquote. Former Washington Post, now Huffington Post, columnist Dan Frumkin wrote in 2006, "Mainstream media political journalism is in danger of becoming increasingly irrelevant, but not because of the Internet or even Comedy Central. The threat comes from inside. It comes from journalists being afraid of what journalists were put on this green earth to do. There's the intense pressure to maintain access to insider sources, even as those sources become ridiculously unrevealing and oversensitive. There's the fear of being labelled partisan if one's bullshit calling isn't meted out in precisely equal increments along the political spectrum. If mainstream media political journalists don't start calling bullshit more often, then we do risk losing our primacy. If not to the comedians, then to the bloggers. I still believe that no one is fundamentally more capable of first-rate bullshit calling than a well-informed beat reporter, whatever their beat. We just need to get the editors, or the corporate culture, or the self-censorship, or whatever it is, out of the way." Unquote. Dan Ellsberg says the government has ordered the media not to cover 9/11. Ellsberg seemed hardly surprised that today's American mainstream broadcast media has so far failed to take former FBI translator and 9/11 whistleblower Sybil Edmonds up on her offer, despite the blockbuster nature of her allegations, which Ellsberg calls far more explosive than the Pentagon Papers. As Edmonds has also alluded, Ellsberg pointed to the New York Times, who sat on the NSA spying story for over a year, when they could have put it out before the 2004 election, which might have changed the outcome. He told us, quote, "There will be phone calls going out to the media saying, 'Don't even think of touching it. You'll be prosecuted for violating national security.'" Unquote.
And then you go further in terms of deep events to not only talk about JFK, but the book you have, where you, the war conspiracy, JFK, 9/11, the deep politics of war. And then your newest book, of course, is the, you know, the American War Machine,
right,
which ties in organized drug dealing worldwide, military empires,
right,
private companies. I mean, just, this military-industrial complex, but 50 years later, literally changing things as they happen. But you look at it somewhat sociologically in the sense that, okay, during JFK and 9/11, there were stock market speculations,
right,
before.
Right.
And other things that you see, like many of the senior officials of the country were absent,
right, yes,
during those events. And what else is commonalities?
There are some things which could have been coincidences. You know, yes, it could be a coincidence that there were stock manipulations just before JFK, stock manipulations. We know there were just before 9/11. And again, the 9/11 Commission did a terrible job on trying to refute that, and they have been amply, I think, refuted in turn. But supposing they were coincidence, what something that is more serious to me is internal to the conspiracy, and that is the president is shot, and 15 minutes later, there is a description of the killer put into the Dallas police messages, which is a description of Oswald as 5'10", 165 pounds, and that's exactly what was in his FBI file and exactly what was in his CIA file, but it wasn't true. When they actually measured him, and he was 5'9" and weighed about 140-something. The same thing happened in 9/11. Before 10 o'clock on September the 11th, we have it in Richard Clark's book that Watson and the FBI is telling him, we have a list of the people, the hijackers on the plane. Where did that come from? We don't know where it came from. We do know, by the way, there's been a lot of investigation of this. There were a couple of names on that list that have since been removed. One of them, for example, was already dead on September the 11th. So how did they know he was on a plane if the man was dead and underground? We don't know how they had that list as quickly as they, but it makes you think that they had.